Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thank you for joining us. I just spoke with Lucas Klein about Notes on the Mosquito, Selected Poems, and this is a book of his translations of the works of contemporary Chinese poet Shi Quan that was just published with New Directions Press in 2012. This is a beautiful book. It's beautiful as a collection of poems. It's beautiful as a collection of paired texts. So each one of the poetic works that's published in the collection here, and there are many of them, so it's a wonderfully rich volume. Each one is presented both in Chinese and in a parallel English translation. And so it's really wonderful for anyone who likes to work between those versions of a text, or who's interested in reading both versions of one of these poems. And they're both versions of each one of these poems is really a creative work in and of itself. It's also really interesting from the perspective of anybody who is engaged with teaching, thinking about, or working on history in China. And one of the really surprising things for me when I sat down and read the book as a historian was how deeply engaged and really thoughtfully engaged and creatively engaged Shi Quan was as an author and Lucas was as a translator with situating the way that each one of these poems engages the texture of what it is as an individual to exist in time and to transform in time with larger ways of thinking about historical transformation. So transformations on a historical timescale and how to engage both of these and negotiate between both of these levels in thinking about historiography. There's a lot in here that's assignable in a history course. And this is not something you might necessarily think of when approaching a book on translations of Chinese poetry. Lucas is exceptionally thoughtful about his work as a translator, about the process of creating the book, of coming to this topic, and of how we might approach not just readings of these translations, but of translations in general of Chinese poetry and beyond. It was really wonderful to talk with him. It's a gorgeous book and one that's well worth reading, so I recommend it highly to you, and I hope you enjoy the ensuing conversation. We're here today to talk with Lucas Klein about his recent translation of Shi Quan's Notes on the Mosquito, Selected Poems. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Lucas, and thank you so much for making the time to talk with me today and given such a dramatic time difference as well. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So, Lucas, could you get us started by saying a little bit about your background? What brought you to the study of and work with contemporary Chinese poetry?
Sure. I guess the first place to start is that I, as an undergraduate, I have a double major in literary studies and Chinese. And I graduated from college right at the time, right before were obvious that, China would be a really interesting sort of business opportunity for a lot of people. And I wasn't very interested in that. And so, that reaffirmed my interest in things literary and cultural and so on. But actually, even before that, I started to studying Chinese quite a bit earlier. I started when I was 16 and lived in China in Beijing when I was for a semester of high school. And I started being interested in China because of, an interest in like ancient Chinese philosophy and Taoism and Gongzi and all of them, things like that. Over time that changed into being interested in literature. And then that too, and specifically poetry, and that too evolves so that as well as being interested in ancient Chinese literature and then living and experiencing contemporary China, I became interested in contemporary Chinese literature. And I noticed that, while there were a lot of people who were interested in contemporary Chinese fiction or in Chinese film and so on, Chinese poetry, contemporary Chinese poetry, was really something that was understudied and underappreciated. And so, as I went through graduate school, I wanted to sort of find a way to bring all of these various different interests together. And I started working on a dissertation that was both about contemporary Chinese poetry and, as it turned out, Tang Dynasty poetry. Sichuan is not actually someone that was in my dissertation. It was the story of how I came to get to know Sichuan and work with Sichuan was sort of a separate issue. But the overall question of Chinese poetry and particularly contemporary Chinese poetry sort of has those origins, at least in my life story.
Great. And can you, I know I'm asking you to reach back now and to think mm-hmm. about something that's sort of at the beginning of this genealogy or certainly at the early stages, but who were some of the contemporary Chinese poets and or what were some of the poems or books that first inspired you to work in this broad field? Do you recall that?
Sure. I mean, Beidao was the first contemporary Chinese poet that I read. A little bit, after that, actually, and then after college, I was living in France for a little while, and I was in touch with, Mabel Lee, who had translated in Australia, and she had translated, Yang Lian, who was a contemporary of Beidao's. And so in that time, I wrote a review of some Beidao books. And then a review of a Yang Lian book that had just been published. And it turned out that Yang Lian was the topic of one of my dissertation chapters. And those are some of the earliest people. I mean, these are people who came out, started publishing poetry independently in the late 1970s and the early 80s. I suppose at a certain way, my interest, sort of my awareness of contemporary Chinese poetry sort of did progress historically, right? And I got to know some of the main writers who were some of the earliest writers of contemporary Chinese poetry in the mainland. They were also not coincidentally two of the writers who were available in English, right? And one of the great things was that their books were published in dual language editions, so I could read the Chinese and read the English and at the same time and sort of compare and figure out how I felt about all that. And, I could, engage my interest in translation too, right? I mean, that's another sort of motivating force for me and my work is this interest in translation that I study and I participate in and so on. And so, these things all kind of worked out. And any different example of this is another instance of me sort of finding these things, poetry in Chinese, contemporary Chinese poetry, poetry in English, translation, all of these things clustering together, book by book or maybe poem by poem.
Right. Now, the book itself that we're talking about today is also, I should mention for listeners who don't know this already, it is a dual language edition. And so the Chinese and your rendering in the English are both available for all the poems, which is really wonderful. The translation itself, and this was actually something that was... It was such a pleasure for me to read, and it was so surprising because there's a lot going on in this book. It's quite a rich book. It's a really extensive translation of poetry that somebody coming to a book of poems may not expect to find in a book of poems. I mean, and we'll get to this over the course of our conversation, but I remember reading through this for the first time and being struck by, wow, I can assign this as historiography in a history class, for some of these poems. Like they range from the just absolutely beautiful and gorgeous sort of meditations on loneliness, bugs, mountains, death, to what are actually some really, really thoughtful historiographical interventions on what it means and what it can mean and what it has meant to do Chinese history. So there's a lot in here, and we'll, over the course of our conversation, I'm sure, get to the kinds of opportunities, but also the kinds of particular challenges that poses, right, for you as a translator, translating across all of these different sorts of styles and modes. How did you, before we get into these specifics, how did you come to be involved in this translation in particular? How did you come to develop the kind of relationship with Sichuan that was necessary for doing this work and choose this work in particular to publish a translation of?
That's a great question. But first of all, I really want to say thank you for the encapsulation that you gave. That's really wonderful to hear. As far as Sichuan goes, there are two two important issues. One is that when I was getting my PhD at Yale, I was part of a group that would meet every other week called the Working Group in Contemporary Poetics. And there were a couple of other members of this group who had met Xichuan and knew him a little bit. And one semester, he was a guest lecturer at NYU. And we brought him to campus for a discussion with our group. And we also, that semester, there was another a tour of a handful of other contemporary Chinese poets, and we brought all of them together to New Haven for a reading at one point. So that was when I first got to meet Xichuan and sort of look at his work seriously in the versions, you know, that had sort of piecemeal been transited here and there. So that was where I got to know him, and I met him, and I really found him to be a really intelligent and genuine and insightful and interesting person. And also, you know, not independently, not coincidentally, writing some of the stuff that I found to be some of the best writing coming out of China today. So I knew who he was, and that was in my mind. I don't know if it was maybe a year later, I had published a book review of a collection of essays that had been published by New Directions. And New Directions is a press that I'd known about from, you know, when I started being interested in poetry anyhow. And if you look at, you know, Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams and Kenneth Rexroth and so on, I mean, these are people who have been published from New Directions, by New Directions for decades and decades. So I wrote a review of a collection of essays. And afterwards, the writer of the collection of essays that I had, who was also a longtime New Directions author, he after reading my review, he wrote to me to express his thanks, and he said, you know, by the way, New Directions has been interested in publishing a Xichuan book for some time, but they haven't really found anybody that they thought would be a good match as a translator, someone that they could really promote. And I guess that, you know, whether it was a combination of the New Directions has been Beidou's translator, publisher in the U.S. for quite some time. And Beidou and Xichuan have had a long relationship as friends and colleagues. So I think that maybe Beidou had told the New Directions that if they wanted to publish another Chinese poet, this would be one of the ones to look at and so on. Because I thought that kind of like an exciting idea, you know, it was not enough for me just to be sort of interested in translation and talking about translation as an important thing in the abstract. I also really wanted to be doing it in an active publishing way. And so I wrote to Xichuan and said, you know, here I have this opportunity. What do you think about that? And he wrote back and he said, that's great. I would love to do it. Where do we begin? And at this point, I'd sort of gotten in touch with New Directions and an editor there already. And so things sort of started to coalesce in that way. As that happened, I mean, that's really the trajectory. It was not a quick process, right? It was not a fast project where, you know, he said, okay, here are these poems, translate them, and then, you know, send them in and they're done. I mean, this is a process that took, years of you know, visions and revisions, as they say, and so on.
So can you, since we're on this topic, can you talk a little bit about the mechanics of that process? So this is something that you mentioned took years and years of revisions, and that would be something that, you know, would be expected for a volume like this. What was the process actually like for you? How did you engage with the author? How often did you correspond? Is this something that you tried to talk about over the phone or in person, or was this via email? Because the mechanics of this and the kind of media that you use to talk about this is particularly interesting, right? When you're talking about a volume that takes the materiality of language so seriously and is so thoughtful about that, I can imagine that the sort of the material aspects of the process of actually producing the translation would also have been something that was really significant in this process.
That's a great way to put this question. We start, as I said, we met in person first. And then after that, when I was living in Connecticut and Xichuan was back in Beijing, we communicated almost exclusively via email. you know, when I would go to Beijing, I would see him, we would meet, you know, maybe days in a row and hours at a time, you know, several hours at a time and go over, my drafts of his work. But something that's important to mention, by the way, is that Sichuan went to an international, school, growing up. You know, he was, one of the kids fortunate enough. He was born in 1963 and he was fortunate enough to go to a school that in Beijing that was pretty much designed, as I understand it, for the children of diplomats. And so there was intensive English education from the very beginning. And he was an English major at Beijing University and graduated in 1985. And so his English, you know, is completely fluent. And so he was then able to, you know, offer his commentary, and corrections and so on my drafts as I was going along. And then that was very, very helpful. Usually when he and I, email, we'll email in English and, you know, he'll write to me in English or he'll write to me in Chinese either way. But I'll write almost exclusively in English. But when we're face to face or we're talking on the phone, it'll be in Chinese. But anyhow, not to get too far ahead of ourselves. It started out over email and not a whole lot of, you know, correspondence really sort of as it was. The first step of the process was, New Directions wanted about 20 pages worth of poetry, to see, you know, sort of how the book might take shape and to see if my translations were good enough for them to really sort of say, okay, we want to see more. And so I asked him for about 20 poems and we agreed that it would be good to cover the breadth of his writing career. And if you read the book, you can tell that there are a lot of changes that have taken place, in his career. And so we wanted to have something that would cover the breadth of that, not something that would just be like what he's doing now or what he did 15 or 20 years ago. So I worked on, you know, 20 or so poems, did a rough draft. I sent them to him. He made some edits. I showed them to other people. I showed them to people who did know Chinese, who didn't know Chinese, who were native speakers of English, who were native speakers of Chinese. And then I sent them into to New Directions and soon enough they got back and said, great, we want to see more. In terms of my correspondence with Sichuan, came about by the time that once I moved to Hong Kong, which is now I'm in my third year here, we started talking on the phone more. He's come to Hong Kong, for a number of times, in that time. And we've become even closer as friends in being able to, you know, to actually spend a significant amount of time in the same place together. And so really, I think we've covered sort of all the bases, right? There's been the written correspondence, there's been the phone, there's been face to face, there's been all of that. And the great thing is that, you know, because, as I said, because his English is so good, you know, he really has sat down with me and he's, you know, looked at the various different options carefully and, you know, often he'll say, oh, I didn't know you could say that in English. You know, he really liked that. You know, he'll sort of jot that down and I'll hear him sort of, next time I hear him say something in English, you know, he'll sort of be referring to a conversation or to a version of my translation of his work that I think is pretty exciting. Also, you know, he's also a translator himself. Recently he translated the poetry of Gary Snyder into Chinese and I got to help him with some of his questions on that too. So that's sort of been the shape of our correspondence and relationship.
See, that's really fascinating, and it immediately raises for me the question: since this is a relationship, a kind of collaborative relationship that is inspiring the kinds of translation that you're doing with his work, and you're inspiring the kinds of translations ostensibly that he's doing on his work and on Gary Snyder's poetry. Did you find at any point in the process of your development as a translator while you were translating this poetry that the kinds of interactions with him about his work and specifically the kinds of edits that he would suggest making to the translations of his work changed qualitatively in any way your approach as a translator? Like, were there any shifts in your own development as a translator and your own approaches to his work in particular that you felt in the process of working together on this book?
Yeah, absolutely. The first issue is that one of the first changes is that, writing a dissertation, and a dissertation very much engaged in questions of translation theory, I had a rather more theoretical kind of take on translation when I started working on these poems. That, you know, once I moved to Hong Kong and started teaching classes in practical translation to non-native speakers of English and native speakers of Mandarin and Cantonese, that, you know, that in itself saw a change in my attitude towards how literary translation should be. And also, dealing with Yichuan, who, as I said, is an experienced translator and so on, that was another part of that kind of change. Another thing that I think is an important point in answering this question is that, you know, on the one hand, Yichuan is not interested in saying, this is what I meant, and that's the only thing that it can mean, right? You know, he's interested in interpretive questions, and he's excited about various different possibilities and potential understandings and divergent readings and so on. So he's never going to say, you know, this is what I meant and it has to be this way. At the same time, he will say, okay, I think you've made a mistake. That's not what I meant. You know, he'll also say, if you think that works better, then fine. But I'll just let you know, this is what I had in mind. So there are a lot of kinds of questions that you might kind of be embarrassed to ask a writer. What did you mean here? What's this really about that he's very comfortable talking about? And at the same time, he's not going to say, you know, that's my intent and you have to honor that, right? And you have to make it say this and not something like that. I mean, there are all sorts of stories a lot of translators don't like to work with living writers because some of them, I'll give you an example. Milan Kundera evidently is very difficult to work with, for translators, but I found Yichuan nothing but very easy and inspiring and fun to work.
That's great. Thank you so much for illuminating that process a little bit. Now, as I've mentioned already, and as we move into the texture of the book itself and the poems themselves, the translation is really wonderful. And it's wonderful on many, many levels. And one of the many levels, aside from it just being just incredibly inspiring poetry, and poetry, that's just, it's such a pleasure also for readers who might have some Chinese and, you know, at any level of language ability, to have both versions there, because they really develop a relationship with each other, right? The Chinese version, if I can call it that, and the English version, if I can call it that. So that layout and that editorial decision itself is really, really, I think it's beautiful for the reader. Now, this collection of poems, there are many poems in here, and there are poems that, as we've already alluded to, range pretty dramatically in time and style. And we'll talk about that over the course of the rest of the conversation. Let's talk a little bit about, in order to get there, the structure of the book as a whole. So the book is separated into two parts. Part one consists of standalone poems, and part two consists of excerpts from larger sequences, from larger works. And there's also at the end an author's note, and we'll talk about that as well. Can you talk about that decision? When you were sitting down and deciding about the structure of the book, how did you decide on this structure? And maybe also, we can talk about a little bit how you decided what to include and what not to include.
Yes, that. Thank you. That's all, again a very interesting question. The first version of the, well, first of all, there's the question of what to include, and basically, you know, Yichuan gave me sort of his sense of, these are the poems that I think are kind of most important to my development since I started publishing in 1985 or so. And so, you know, these are the poems that I think I've been working on the last, 20 some years that I think are the ones, you know, worth keeping and that I want to share with a readership in a different language. But the order that he gave them to me, it was quite different. And it was, at first it was largely chronological, but then there were some places where, you know, here's a poem from, you know, this year put right up against a poem from another year that share a certain kind of theme. And, you know, by the time I had a full manuscript, it was pretty clear to me that wasn't going to work. You know, because too many of these sort of similar themes, maybe a Chinese readership likes that. They want that kind of continuity. And here's one poem and it leads to another poem, a very similar theme, and it leads to another poem, a similar theme. But for me, and I felt maybe for American readers too, that would, or readers in English, that would be a little, that would end up getting too repetitive. And I thought it would be better to break them out. And so the next thing we did was we set and pretty much had it be more or less completely chronological, but you know, a big break, you know, at I know what it was. It was the second sort of version. It was, there was section A and there was section B, or, you know, part one, part two, and part one was only the shorter poems, the sort of the lyrical pieces, right? And then the second, they got up to, you know, 92, 93, 94, maybe a few of those sort of straggling in there. And then part two was all of the longer, sort of more expansive pieces. And I think that, you know, when I sent in the full manuscript to New Directions, that was sort of what we needed to be. Our editor at New Directions said, this is a little hard to follow. And you know, and again, sort of stylistically, things are maybe not being, not sort of asserting their own, you know, these pieces aren't asserting their own voices in the right kind of ways. And so he proposed a different way of doing it. And then Xichuan himself said, okay, this is how I really think it should be. I still really want there to be a separation of section one and section two. And I want there to be a chronological division to say, this is what I was doing at this point. This is what I was doing at this point. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, a lot of his writing is historiographic. And so in the arrangement of his own work, I think that he had that sense of, you know, his own historical progression too. You know, and considering that, you know, I think a lot of us, you know, are pretty familiar with the really big changes in China, you know, in the 80s and the 90s and then in the new millennium, you know, really, I mean, Chinese society has changed in a lot of ways. And you know, Xichuan's writing has also changed in ways that offer particular commentaries on those sort of social changes too. And so I think that is another reason why there's, you know, in section one, it's first the 80s, then the 90s, then the 2000s. And then in section two, the longer poems, it's also still broken up into the 90s and then the 21st century.
Right. Let's actually, this leads us really nicely to another really brief set of questions that's really germinal, I think, to understanding your decisions as a translator and also how you suggest that, or you're imagining that readers approach this work that you've created and you've produced along with Xichuan. You've mentioned the importance of, and I think this makes a ton of sense, the chronological development of the poems and the chronological structure in some way mirroring Xichuan's own interest in history and historical development and genealogy. I mean, and this is something, this interest in chronology and the place of the individual in time, and the sort of the idea of a lifespan is really also something that you see coming up, just, you know, as a footnote, thematically in a lot of the poems, right? One of the mosquito poems explicitly references the lifespan of right. the insect. And so this interest in the development of an individual in time, through time, with time, you know, the resonances of life and death and the interests in these themes also comes up in the poem. This all makes a lot of sense, which raises the dimension of this work and of understanding this work that has to do with the author's own biography. So you mentioned this briefly in the introduction. You mentioned that Xichuan was in Beijing during Tiananmen in 1989. How much of his own political and social background do you think shaped the way you approached the work? How relevant do you think it is? Or perhaps that's not the right way of putting it. How much do you think readers' experience of the poetry is should be shaped by their knowledge of his background. Basically, what I'm asking you then is two kinds of questions. So one, how much did taking into account his own political, social, cultural background shape your approach to the poems? And conversely, on the other hand, how much do you think that individual personal genealogy is important for a reader to understand and engage with the poems? So I'm throwing a lot at you, but there's two threads here.
Mm-hmm. But again, that's a really great question, and it's great because it's such a complex question. I guess I would say, it's all very important, but it's not important in the sense that it's a very direct sort of, in order to appreciate this poem, you've got to understand that he was, I'm not very interested in that kind of reading, I don't get the sense that Chichuan is very interested in that kind of thing. Like, in order to understand this, you've got to know what it was like to live in Beijing in 1973 or 1994. That seems to me that the point then is not about the writing, but the point is about pretending the writing doesn't exist and that it transports you to some other kind of, time or place. And I think that, with Chichuan still, the focus is always on the writing itself. But that being said, the writing seems to me to be a commentary on the changes or the ways in which Chinese society or global society or whatever the changes that have been going through. Let me give you an example. I think about this, the sort of the recent discussions about the Nobel Prize and Mo Yan and so on. And a lot of people, criticize Mo Yan for what they perceive to be his political stance or his lack of a political stance and so on. And it seems to me that there's a very sort of assumption of a very straightforward correspondence between art and society that's going on there. And I think, at least with Chichuan, I think it's a lot more complex than that. In his afterword, he talks about the oxymoron being an important thing. And so, he brings out the oxymoron as something in his poetry. And there's a political element to that because in some way, and not a direct way, but in a rather, in a rather oblique way, that's a commentary on certain things that have happened in Chinese society. And he talks about, whether you talk about people's democratic dictatorship. He says Mao and Deng Xiaoping were masters of the oxymoron, right? The people's democratic dictatorship or the socialist market economy. He said, these are oxymoronic, and at the political or economic level, we might be frustrated by that and call it hypocritical. But it also opens itself up to a kind of literary reading where we can have a different kind of angle on that and understand the complexity of the text that is China with its own complexity of a text that is a different kind of poem. So does that sort of make sense as a way to answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely.
The point is that, it's not, when I read a poem like, Written at 30, right, which traces, Chinese society in the 30 years that he had been living at that time, it's not important to me to say, oh, this is exactly about, this campaign of the culture of, this is about when he was living in thus and such, or this is when he was a university student at Beijing University. Those individual sort of specific placements of where he was don't matter to me so much as this is, a point of view offering a complex commentary on a complex situation.
Right. Now, there are elements, though, in the kind of the personal genealogy and the political genealogy of the author that did shape the way the texture of the poems shifts over the course of time as they're reflected here. And that's, in particular, I'm gesturing toward this shift that seems to happen around 1991. So can you talk a little bit about this shift in the nature of his poetry in whatever way you want to lay that out?
Right. As I said, he graduated as an English university in 1985, and that was also when he started writing. And he was coming out as a poet in the middle of the 80s. And I mentioned Beidou and Yang Lian. And so in some ways, you know, the poetry that was coming out in Meichuan and his good friends, Luo Yihe and Haizi and a few others as well, they were writing something that in some ways was a response against the kind of the Beidao and Yangnian and what was called the obscure, or sometimes it's translated as misty, the Menglong poetry. And in some ways it was a continuation of that. And, you know, it was, you know, this guy who was at this moment of cultural opening up, and people thought it was enlightenment in China in the 1980s. And things seemed really hopeful, and there was a lot of idealism, and he's an English major, and he was there's a sort of internationalist kind of atmosphere, and he's writing these lyrical pieces, and he seems to be very interested in beauty, and I think really, in a lot of ways, really achieving that. And he sort of makes a name for himself early on in that kind of a poetic mode. When 1989 comes around, a number of things happen, right? First of all, you know, as we know, there's the Tiananmen Square demonstrations, and then the fact that it was crushed by the government, right? The tanks rolled in and people were killed. You know, and so he was a young man at that time. He had been in Tiananmen Square, not on the day of the massacre, but in some of the days leading up to that. So that was a tumultuous thing for him to experience. But also before that, the two friends of his that I just mentioned, Haizi and Luo Yihe, both, again, in their early 20s, they died. Luo Yihe died, of a brain hemorrhage. And if I'm not mistaken, he died of a brain hemorrhage on Tiananmen Square. So he may have been, you know, the first casualty of those demonstrations. This was before anything had gotten violent. Even before that, Haizi killed himself. So all of these things sort of in quick succession, right? The suicide of one friend, the death of another, and then the government coming in and crushing the political demonstrations of his generation in Beijing. Now, this was very traumatic. And he wrote much less for the next couple of years, and published almost nothing for the next couple of years. And when he did start publishing again, it was very, very different, right? He was not writing these contained lyrics that seemed interested in engaging with beauty and sort of kind of what we think of as the essence of lyric poetry everywhere. Rather, he was writing these very expansive kind of these very expansive kind of prose poems that, much more curious, darker in some ways, but also funnier, really much more interested in trying to sort of open up the possibilities of poetry rather than sort of assume that poetry only means that one thing that he thought it meant in the 80s. So that, I think, you know, I think as a narrative too, right, there's a reason that we want to see people change, and we want to see people go from being really good in one area to then turning back and questioning that and becoming really good in something that's a development and a reaction against that thing that had defined their excellence early on. And so I think that Sichuan comes with this kind of, comes with this narrative already in his development. And of course, you know, a lot of people will then take sides and, you know, kind of like Bob Dylan, you know, I like early Dylan, or I like the late Dylan, or whatever. It's, you know, the something happens similar with Sichuan. I guess this is my Bob Dylan theory of Chinese literature.
Now, this is actually really fascinating to know about, to hear about, and it raises another set of questions that I'd actually love to start asking you right now, which is being sensitive to this kind of change in style, change in the nature of the kind of work and the goals of the work that come along with a personal transformation of the author, puts particular demands on you as a translator, right? So this sort of, if not demands, I'll phrase it as challenges. What were some of the challenges that you faced as a translator in trying to embody in English and represent and do justice to this kind of transformation and this range in different poetic styles and different linguistic registers in the original poetry?
Yeah, again, that's a great question. But the biggest challenge is simply, you know, how do I imagine this? What's the appropriate equivalence? And when I say equivalence, I'm not talking about, you know, what does this word mean? I mean, obviously sometimes that is an issue. Right? What does this word mean? The dictionary definition doesn't seem very helpful. But really, I mean, how, not as much. I think basically what does this mean is a much easier question and a much more easily solved question than how does this mean? How should this be said? So that's exactly the issue, right? What is the kind of, you know, if there's a way in which Xichuan's writing in Chinese engages with and defines itself by some sort of relationship with or against, you know, spoken language of Chinese, the spoken language of Beijing, in a Beijing accent, contemporary Chinese writing, history, you know, classical Chinese literary history and so on that people might be familiar with. You know, how do I engage that in English? There are a couple of moments in the English translation where I will throw in an allusion to something from somewhere else in English or Western literary culture that is not an exact equivalence to what Xichuan maybe does in vis-a-vis Chinese culture at that moment, but does, say, take the place of an allusion, a reference, a wink, or something that I may have let drop at another moment. Right? So at one point, maybe I'll say, oh, here's a little sort of nudge towards, you know, William Wordsworth or something like that, which will get at a nudge maybe that Xichuan has towards, let's say, you know, Su Shi, that at that given moment I couldn't quite bring over. So I think that the challenge really is to be, you know, as cognizant of all of these, of all sorts of different possibilities in the range of different expressions in English as Xichuan is in Chinese.
And did any part of your process, and then I'll get to the poems themselves right after this, but did any part of the process of translating for you mirror at all the kind of change in style that you see reflected in the poetry? And by that, I mean, was there anything like you started with the early ones first and then worked your way toward the late ones? Or did the order in which you approached the poems just, was it more random than that?
The way that I translated it, well, first we had the 20 poems that we wanted to give as a proposal, as a book proposal first. And so I translated, and those were in chronological order, but there were only 20 of them. And so I did those, and I worked on those drafts many, many times to get them to where I thought they were good enough. And then I did the whole manuscript that at the time was arranged straightforward. That's not true. It was not arranged straightforward chronologically. It was generally chronologically, but there were moments of mixture and so on in there. And so I think I translated it first according to that, and then we rearranged the order, and I went through the drafts and so on, and the edits and revisions. So at any given moment, I had to be, you know, here, this is where Xichuan is, he's at this sort of phase as a writer. And I had to be translating with that kind of question in mind.
Right. Great. So we've talked about the process. We've talked about the structure. Let's get into the poems themselves. There's a lot of beauty in this volume, and there's also a lot of thoughtfulness. And this is both in both versions of all of the poems. And like I've said, it's really, really striking. What are some of your... Let's start with favorites. What were there any that you felt particularly moved by as a reader and or particularly challenged by or moved by as a translator?
Absolutely. Although I will have to say that, you know, when you are translating something and you're reading something as deeply as a translation requires, you know, your emotions will change with every kind of reading. And I may be really moved by this poem. I could read a poem first, and then I'll be really moved by the first sort of stanza, and then I'll find the second stanza, you know, completely opaque and won't be able to understand it. Or then when I'm translating it, I'll find it really fun at first, and then I'll find it really tedious, or I'll find, or you know, all of the kinds of all of these issues come up again and again because you have to deal with these pieces at such an intense level. But here's one. Let me see if I can find this. I'll read this. It's quite short. It's one that, you know, when I first translated it, I don't think that it really, you know, meant a lot to me. I sort of did a quick draft and that was it. And then I, you know, a few tweaks here and there. But it wasn't until much later, after I pretty much had a complete draft, that I felt like this poem was as interesting as. So it's called Rereading Borges's Poetry for Anne. And my translation the precision of this statement emerges from the chaos of the past. This pure force, like the rhythm of a dripping faucet, annotates the aporia of history. Touching starlight, I leave night to the earth, night that licks the earth's crevices, that fourth memory. No man is a man. Nowhere is a place. And no man in nowhere has written these lines I must decipher in the shadows. I give up scouring the world of dust for the author and lift my head to see a librarian lethargically and only for his livelihood preserving the order of the universe and books.
Wow. Thank you. So can you talk about this poem? Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, what I really like about this is that I mean, I guess, you know, I sort of mentioned that I got to a point in grad school where I, you know, ended up being really theoretical and treating translation very theoretically. And I think I got to a point at the same time where I was treating literature very theoretically, and I sort of, you know, accepted a certain critique of the lyric that, you know, that lyric poetry had sort of stopped. It no longer had an effect on me. In the same way. And so, I was drawn to Teuton prose pieces, prose poems, expansive, longer series poems in ways, and I think that's great. And I'm still, of course, very drawn to those. But it was reading this poem in a certain way after I had already thought I was pretty much done with it, that sort of opened up the possibility of a lyric poetry, of a lyric poem being more than what, you know, my adopted sort of critique of lyric poetry has been. And I guess what I like about this is that, you know, it's a poem about poetry, right? And it's a poet writing about a poet. And it's specific, and there are certain things that if you know Borges, you know he was a librarian, you know that he was blind, he wrote about books, and he wrote precisely worded meditations on historical and also cosmic kind of topics, and also just that he's such a master technician. And Sichuan has said that, you know, two of his favorite poets are Borges. And in English, we don't even really think of Borges as a poet primarily. I think we think of him as a fiction writer. Mm-hmm. But Sichuan has said that two of his favorite poets are Borges and Ezra Pound. And he feels like sometimes when he feels like he's too sort of controlled and confined, he reads Pound to sort of loosen himself up. And when he feels like he's too wild and too out there and extravagant, he'll read Borges to rein himself back in. And I really like that kind of attitude. And so, you know, the first line of this poem, which I found, the vision of this statement emerges from the chaos of the past, I think really, you know, brings out that tension that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. And the even some of your choice of words in the translation, the forked, for anybody who reads Borges, right, they're immediately going to think that's immediately going to evoke Borgesian, or at least the translated version of Borgesian language, right, that a lot of us, a lot of English readers will have grown up reading. Like is that the Garden of Forked Paths, right? Like you can't use use the word forked in any kind of poem that involves Borges and not evoke that imagery, right? So it's actually quite a really brilliant decision on your part to do that.
Well, thank you. That is a decision, you know, it's there, right? I mean, the word in Chinese is actually the word that the Chinese translation of Garden of Forked Paths uses too. So I think so that's not me as a translator, determining something to be there that may or may not be there in the original, but that I think we can be sure, we can be confident enough to say that that is there in Qigong. But there are other kinds of moments, right? I say annotates the aporia of history, right? And aporia is this word that, you know, is very much associated these days, well, maybe not these days anymore, but has been recently with, you know, post-structuralist, deconstructive literary criticism and so on. And, I could have picked another word, but because Borges has been so much sort of adopted or embraced by that kind of, mode of reading of literature, that I felt like a word like that could be justified.
Now, you had mentioned earlier that there was one of, you also had a poem from the later set that you were interested in sort of reading and talking about. Do you mind doing another reading for us? Because this is great.
I don't mind at all. But before I do one from the later, can I do an earlier one?
Oh, actually, yes, please. Absolutely. Go for it.
This is, because you're asking about biography and commentary on society and so on, I wanted to read Written at 30. And so Xichuan was born in 1963, and he slowed down his writing a lot after 1989 for a couple of years. And so in 1993, he was sort of getting back in writing. And soon enough, his writing would change. But here's something that's sort of right at the hinge between his earlier mode and his later mode. And it's a little bit longer than the Borges one, but I hope we're okay on time.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Written at 30. In my first decade, the moon revealed its silent craters. While under that moon, in the town I lived in, a clatter of exorcismal gongs and shouts in the street, my limping uncle swore in the courtyard. Careless, I met with a white rooster's kiss, and a girl pulled down her pants in front of me. I ran into a suicide shade on the stairs and was instructed to not be scared. My father lifted me over his head, pale bounced in exhaustion on the road to the commune. I entered an immaculate school and studied revolution. In my second decade, with working crickets of all countries, I grew up. Together we scorned difficulty. Together fell in love with violence and moonlight. A tiger appeared at my door. I smelled the scent of flesh. I bunny hopped to a stranger's doorway and saw a man and woman preparing their festive attire. I stole, and others stole too. I set fire to sparrows, and others did too, such as life. But I had an outstanding gift for painting ideals of mountain landscapes without too many sins requiring forgiveness. Some doors shut, some doors were yet to open. My third decade was for travel and study. It made sense to torment myself. I sang for the brow and knees of love, but saw no fairy queens descend on the streets. Friends came, wild and vivacious, then vanished, leaving me a shirt and glasses, but no way to wear them. The spearhead of judgment called forth catastrophe, as riots of flesh that called forth rainstorms. I shouldered an umbrella and climbed up a hill, a bird searching for someone greeting thunder and lightning, making circles in the rain. How can you doubt both yourself and the world at once? You can't stop the rain, can't get a bird to land in your hand. Thoughts like a knife, a flick of the blade, drenches my spirit in sweat. I drive out 30 contentious philosophers and say to the shadow who guards me, I'm sorry. Salty sweat, salty tears. What else is flesh supposed to taste like? Night is like a display of identical rooms I walk through, pacing back and forth as if it were all one room. Morning to night, my worries for the future prove I'm ill at ease. The earth is in motion, but I have yet to sense it. So one point that I wanted to make about, you know, the translation and his poetry and so on, the second stanza, in my second decade, he's talking basically about the years 1973 to 1983. So the first 3 years of which would have been the end of the Cultural Revolution. I translated this in my second decade, with working crickets of all countries, I grew up. And he says, in Chinese, he says, 在我第二个十年, 全世界的蟋蟀和我一起成长. And, the 全世界的蟋蟀, just, you know, basically that means all the world's crickets, right? But, he explained to me that, you know, writing about the 1970s in China and everywhere there was Maoist discourse and Marxist discourse and so on, you know, just hearing the expression, you know, 全世界, right, the whole world. Today, you know, maybe you would translate that as meaning the whole world, right? Or everything in the world or something else. But, you know, 全世界的蟋蟀 in Chinese, I think, is much more, and he explained this to me, you know, he was doing this consciously sort of writing through the Maoist rhetoric of the era. And so I felt like if I would have just said, you know, with all the world's crickets, I grew up with all the world's crickets, that would have been insufficient. And so I had to change that and tweak that a little bit in English to add that sort of layer of Marxist kind of rhetoric. And so, you know, I went back to you know, the Communist Manifesto and working men of all countries and that kind of language. And so with working crickets of all countries, I grew up. That's how I come to that kind of a line.
That's totally great. Is there anything else about the poem that you want to, like, what about this poem in particular struck you as being, you know, especially interesting from the perspective of a translator?
I mean, this is another one of those moments where, you know, it does raise the question, I think, of, you know, how much knowledge of China is required of a reader, right?
Right.
I mean, Americans are notoriously, English speakers in just about everywhere are notoriously bad at reading works in translation, right? I mean, the story is that only 3% of books published in English every year are translations. And of that 3%, you know, how many, like maybe a third of those are manga, right? Another large percentage are just going to be cookbooks or manuals or books of all sorts of other varieties, right? So actually, actual literary translations is way, way, way below 3%. Maybe we're closer to 1%. And, you know, one of the, I mean, there are many reasons that this is a sad situation, but one of the reasons for that is that, you know, it's hard to appreciate something if you don't know enough about the culture that it comes from. So how important is it to know about China before you start reading poetry from contemporary China? One of the things that I think that the ways in which that poem is an interesting answer is because, you know, any one of those lines, right? I don't think you have to know what exactly it refers to, but you do know that it refers to, and it's the combination of the various somethings and the references that all come together in a poem that creates that narrative and that creates that sort of expression. And that anybody, you know, you don't have to be 30, right? Anybody at any point in life can relate in some way, I think, to that kind of an experience, right? We can all say, oh yeah, this happened when I was, you know, when I was in my teens, this happened. When I was in my 20s, this happened. And we can offer a kind of meditation on that, but it's both, you know, concrete and yet kind of nebulous at the same point.
Right. And there's also something that about this that actually brings us nicely into a question about the author's afterword, if I can ask, which is there are some readers who would read this and immediately get a reference to works of Confucius, right? When I was in my teens, when I was in my 20s, when I was 30 and 40. And it's this sort of play with the idea of a person living in time right now with an engagement with some idea of or some way to play with something we might consider tradition that animates a lot of what's going on in a lot of the poems here. This is, of course, also something that comes up in a really striking, super useful, totally assignable for historians. I just want to put that out there, like in history courses, and I'm going to do this afterward at the end of the book, called The Tradition This Instant. So could you say a little bit about that piece and the place of that piece in the larger structure of the book and for you as a translator?
I think that... That's another interesting question, right? Because I think that, you know, that piece was written, I think Sichuan wrote that for a specific, you know, in response to a certain debate that was current in amongst intellectuals and writers in China at a certain moment. And if I'm not mistaken, that's dated, I'll look at it, dated, you know, 2011, right? So really just a couple of years ago. And that was the last thing that I translated from the book, by the way. And then translated almost the, I translated the entire book of poems. And then we were looking for a prose piece to throw in as, not to throw in, but to use. And so Xichuan had pretty much just finished that and just published it in China and said, here, this I think is representative of a lot of encompassing a lot of what I want to say, as a sort of a cultural commentator. And so the question really is about, you know, this issue of, you know, tradition and the various ways in which not only tradition, but traditions and the many different strands of tradition come together at once. And really, let's take a look at all of the different things that define our experience and kind of, you know, let's historicize them, right? Let's consider them from different angles. Let's look at them up close and look at them with a bit of distance, too. And I think that, you know, and there's a way in which that offers his, a sense of, you know, his poetics there. But as you said, I mean, I don't think that you have to have much interest or knowledge about poetry whatsoever to find that a very interesting kind of commentary. I'm actually very curious about how, readers, who know very little about China would approach or appreciate something like that. I don't have very much of a sense of that.
Now, this before we kind of move to the close here and come to the conclusion, that concern with or maybe explicit evocation of history and a way of thinking about history and doing history and thinking about it in the context of literature. His own literature and a broader context of literature in China of China is also something that animates the poems in the later part of the book. Was there any, before we close and, you know, kind of wrap up, were there any of the poems in the later part of the book that you wanted to single out for special attention while we're here?
Sure. Yeah. One of my favorites of that section and the last few poems are called 30 Historical Reflections. If I'm not mistaken, he's written more than 30 at this point. I don't know if he's going to add, you know, if he's going to change the title to 40 Historical Reflections or 50 or whatever, or he'll just keep it 30, but there will be more than 30. I'd be interested in knowing what he does with that. But I think that he's still writing these sort of sequences. He sort of calls them poessays, you know, because they're both poems and essays at the same time. But that person writing is one of my favorites. I'll read it here. 80 wooden slips, like a line of old men linked by fate. The seal script writing interposed in the slips is difficult to discern, but what it conveys about heaven, the state, war, and the thoughts of the sages remains unchanged. The work of the brush of this anonymous writer looks like the brushwork of Sima Qian or Sima Xiangyu. Only at a remove of 2,000 years can the customary greatness of his era be perceived. From afar, he may yet have glimpsed Sima Xiangru or Sima Qian. He dips his brush in ink, working stroke upon stroke, permitting himself not one false word, writing the aphorisms of Zeng Zi, delighting in his thoughts. He's nearly convinced that the thoughts he transcribes will be of great use to humanity. These thoughts he protects. These thoughts he transmits. Wittingly or not, certain words are altered. Wittingly or not, he retains his own breath within the views of another. From a humble stenographer, he unwittingly transforms into a minor author of this great author, like an ant tethering thought's kite against the wind. Sunlight spilling onto the writing desk, he sneezes. On the street, shoe sellers call out to him, you're the guy who deals in thought. He writes on wooden slips in a time before the invention of paper or movable type, and so what he writes is the one book. Each book so written must be the one book. But later, a dead man takes his book underground. The thought that evolved from this book, the thoughts that were transformed from this book, would ultimately reshape the world. But this one book, through the slow stretch of time, was no more to be found. And now, even if it were to be brought back to light, those thoughts transformed from it, the thought adopted by the world, could never be corrected. Like a forgery re-entering the site of civilization. And that person writing, it's as if he had never been born. He is a speck of dust on the earth, disseminating civilization in its limited way.
So can you say a little bit about what is striking you about this poem? Why is this one of your favorites? What do you feel, or what about this particularly inspires you?
I feel a real attachment to that poem because, as I understand that it's about questions of historiography and what it means to write and to transcribe and to record, and also it's a poem about the creative process, right? And what it means to write something that you're not transcribing, but what it's like to write something that you see as some sort of commentary on, you know, society or history or whatever, but you're up against, you know, you're sort of a minor author next to great authors or an ant tethering a kite against the wind. I also see it at the same time, you know, and this is my personal, you know, idiosyncratic reading. I see it as an expression of what it's like to be a translator. And all of these anxieties of, you know, wittingly or not, I retain my own breath within, you know, the voice of transcribing another. And so I feel like that, that's a great example of how, you know, sort of writing itself is always going to involve these kinds of issues, and poetry and translation are always going to involve these issues. And I think that, you know, that's something that I come back to, again and again, you know, in that particular poem.
Well, Lucas, it's been such a pleasure in so many ways. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today about this really wonderful work. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners? Anything in the book?
One of the things that I think I will say this, right? We are now, and it's not about this book specifically, but it's about the state of contemporary Chinese poetry in English, right? From the late 70s until only a couple of years ago, right? There were many anthologies of contemporary Chinese poetry and actually there still continue to be anthologies of contemporary Chinese poetry in English, right? And these are books that have, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 to 25 different poets and a handful of poems by different poets. And maybe they're translated by the same translator. Maybe they're translated by a whole hodgepodge of various different translators, often trying to say, this is what, you know, Chinese writing is today or whatever. But the problem was that in that moment, right, these anthologies had squeezed out the possibility of an individual author, an individual poet's collection, with the exception of poets who had been exiled, right? So Beidao and Yang Lian and Duo Duo were the only people who had were the only Chinese poets, mainland Chinese poets, living mainland Chinese poets who had their work published in English translation. And a couple of years ago, that finally broke. There's a series edited by Zephyr Press of contemporary Chinese poetry. There's this book, it's the second living Chinese poet that New Directions has ever published. And Beidao is the first in Mao Zedong. And they've done, you know, Gu Cheng, who died in the early 90s, and also, you know, Li Bai and Du Fu and so on, but they're not living anymore. In addition to that, and then there's University of Oklahoma has a Chinese Literature Today series. And so really we're at this, you know, this crest of more Chinese, contemporary Chinese poetry is being published. I think it's, you know, we're finally at a point where we can have Chinese poetry be represented by more than just a handful of poems by a really large number of poets. And actually we can have, you know, book length collections being published. And I think that's a really exciting thing for readers, for people interested in China, people interested in Chinese literature, and so on.
Great. Now that this book is out, and I know you're busy right now also, there's a blog that is online that's also called Notes on the Mosquito, and I'll make sure to include a link for listeners. What's next for you? What are you working on now? Is there another poet you're interested in translating? Is there other kind of work that you're doing? What's inspiring you right now?
I have... I guess there are three big projects that I'm working on. Let's make that four. One is a really long-term project. I'd like to do a collection of poems by the Tang Dynasty called Li Changyu. And that would be a very different kind of work, and that's going to be many years in the future. I'm sort of doing that slowly. Also, I'm working the seminal contemporary poet Meng Ke, who was another one of those figures from the late 70s and early 80s, friends with Bei Dao and Yang Lian at the time. So I'm doing a translation of a collection of his book, a collection of his works, and that's for the Zephyr Press series that I just mentioned. Also, I'm working on a book-length academic work, which is a revision of my dissertation, which is on Chinese poetry in the 20th century and in the Tang Dynasty and questions of world literature. Those are some of the projects that I'm working on at the moment. Also, I have a son who's 2.5 weeks old today. So that's a project that I think will take some time too.
The most important project.
That's right, the most important one.
Well, Lucas, I'll let you get back to him and to that really important work. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure, and thanks for making the time, and especially given the time difference we're working on.
That's been absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.